the power of imagination to solve our problems, to create a better world. Imagining the Future with Doug Foresta. Empower Radio. EmpowerRadio.com.
Welcome to another episode of Imagining the Future. And I can't think of a better guest to have on talking about imagination than my guest today, Thomas Moore, who truly needs very little introduction because he is the author of Care of the Soul and many, many other books. One of the books that he wrote, Reenchantment of Everyday Life, actually all of his books talk a lot about, certainly a lot about imagination. But today we're going to talk about natural magic and enchantment, and I'm very excited about it. So thank you so much, Thomas Moore, for joining me.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks. So yeah, why don't we start with the idea of, I love this idea of natural magic, and perhaps you could explain to people what does that mean? What would that mean?
Well, it's an idea that I get from the studies in the Italian Renaissance that I did many years ago. And for them, they called it in Latin magia naturalis, so they used the term natural magic. And they meant natural because they wanted to distinguish it from black magic or sort of satanic magic or even white magic, which would be supernatural. They wanted to say that there's a way of being in this world, in the natural world, and use the natural world in a way that is more magical than rational and controlling the way we normally do it. And so they developed methods in which we could be more magical in our approach to life.
And perhaps maybe you can speak to, so what would be the purpose? Cause that kind of doesn't sound right, but sort of what are the benefits or what are some of the things that comes out of living a more magical life versus living a practical life per se?
Well, and, you know, in some ways, their magic was funny in a way that it was so practical. For example, they were interested in using words and developing, knowing about letters that words consist of, to use them in a way that would be really persuasive for people, so that even today, if you look at the way advertisers use language, how they make up words or how the words are put on a page in the colors that are used, all of that would be considered magic in the Renaissance. It would mean magic in the sense that an advertiser can't force somebody to buy their product, but you can entice them. And that enticement was part of the magic. So if you could live in the world in such a way that you could entice the world itself to help you, or to entice people to do things that would help you, that would be living magically. Now the magicians of that time were not all so pragmatic. Sometimes they would use these powers for the health of a person. So, for example, they would what we call today music therapy would be considered natural magic. So if you could find music that would make a person feel better physically or get them out of their depression, that would be considered a magical use of something like sound.
You know, as you say that, I think about something that, you know, many people will do, and certainly, you know, you are by training is one of your, you know, one of the things that you've done among the many is therapy, and how we think of speech and talking to someone that it's going to, there's an expectation that some magic will be performed and will be our depression will be transformed or somehow our feelings or will be transformed. I was thinking about that as you were talking about it.
Yes, well, that's exactly it. You know, I do therapy all the time, and I know that if I could explain to a person, if I could do it, why they're going through what they are, why they're feeling depressed, that may not make them feel better, even if I could do that. So what I have to do is find ways to talk and be with a person so that they actually discover things, or that they are pulled out of their depression, or maybe go through it, you know, to the other end of it, so they're not burdened by it anymore. And the method is more magical than rational. So it's not about figuring a person out and helping them rationally understand themselves. Much more, it's about how to have a conversation that helps them be initiated through the depression, So I think therapy is very largely a magical process.
One of the things I'm interested in too is that you talked about how, for example, you wrote The Reenchantment of Everyday Life, quite a while ago, and yet it seems like it's interesting to see how it sounds like you have some lectures coming up and some things coming up and sort of reincarnating that you're thinking about those things.
Yes, well, I have to say, to be honest about it, that when I published Reenchantment of Everyday Life, I saw that book as the third step in my books on the soul. The first one, Care of the Soul, was just about what it means to live a soulful life. The second book was called Soulmates, and then I thought that relationships were the next thing that most on people's minds. And then I thought I wanted to write about how to be in the world in a soulful way. And that's why I wanted to write about living in an enchanted world. I didn't make that word up. It's been used a lot by certain people to mean that that most of us live in a world that's mechanical, that we're taught by science to see the world as being made up of chemistry and that sort of thing. And you look at it through microscopes and telescopes. So I wanted to return to a sense that the world itself is enchanted. So maybe having a relationship to the natural world around you and to the magical use of stone and wood and iron, that kind of thing. I thought it would be good, and I still use it in my lectures at hospitals, telling them how important it is to have stone and natural elements in a hospital instead of all plastic and artificial material. So that's magic, and I bring it to my work in medicine. But people didn't get that point. I guess it's either too subtle or they're really more interested in their relationships than they are in living in a magical world. So that was not terribly successful. And so I kind of abandoned it, thinking that, well, people just aren't interested. The book, I have lots of copies of that book because, I mean, it sold a lot, many thousands of copies, not as much as the others. So recently I thought, well, I'm really interested in this. And personally, I got... people have always asked me, my family especially, to read tarot cards because I know imagery pretty well, and I can do the cards, but I do it in kind of a rational way, but I do it. Then I discovered that I could do much more with tea leaves, and my grandmother used to read tea leaves, so I tried that. They were really effective. And then I discovered this mirror that's made of obsidian that's highly polished. And I saw it in the British Museum. John Dee, who was a practitioner of natural magic in the 16th century, used this mirror. And I thought, well, I'm going to try that. And that has been even more potent to me than the tea leaves. So I don't go around. Before, I didn't want to go around telling people I was doing these things. They think I was crazy. But now I'm old enough, I don't care. So I'm giving workshops now, and I've learned so much from the mirror, from just looking into a mirror. I've learned a lot about imagery and how to be in the world in a magical way. So I want to give workshops on it.
You know, it's so funny because I think about how, we have that need for, I think there's a hunger for magic, and even the most rational scientific person will often wear white coats. And I think, well, what is that?
Yes, of course. Well, I asked the doctors, what are you doing wearing that stethoscope around your neck? Just because it's handy? I don't think so. It's a little bit like the shaman or the medicine man or woman wearing beads around the neck. There's something about that you surround your head with some object that is like a sort of like a bottom type of halo. It kind of gives you it gives you a circle around your head, and it gives you a certain power in your practice. So I think that's magic.
I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the mirror. I was reading about that you've been working with it, but can you say a little bit more about how that works?
Well, it's a little hard to describe, but I could try. What I do is I have this very highly polished mirror. It's black. It looks a little bit like mine's quite big. It looks a little bit like a LP record. But it doesn't have any lines in it, just perfectly smooth. And I look into it, and of course, the first thing I see are the reflections from the ceiling or from the world around me. I'll turn the mirror so that I can see different things in it. And then, usually immediately, within a few seconds, an image comes to the foreground. I mean, I kind of go into a half little trance, and I see an image that that comes forward. And then immediately, that the literalness of the image disappears. And I see it more as, I don't know how to describe it. It's not a symbol, really. That would be too rational, but I just look at it, and I can see a lot of things in that image. Usually someone's asking me a question about something they want to think about, a decision to make or something like that. And then, strangely, ideas or messages or something start shooting out from this image. I don't know how else to put it. They're very subtle. It's like when you have thoughts that go by very quickly. And if you don't catch them quickly, then they disappear. You've probably had that experience when, you know, you had a thought, you saw something that really made you think you should do something, and you ignored it. And later you realize, well, that's the kind of thing I see in the mirror. And but I have to be very alert to catch those things. And I use them then to, to answer the person's questions. And I find that as I stick with that image and just stay in that kind of a very, very tiny trance, I can answer almost any questions that people present.
One of the things that you wrote recently about this idea of having the door ajar, and you know, the theme of the show is about, you know, imagining, about imagination.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about, I really loved that, what you wrote. I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit about that idea of having the door ajar, and what you meant by that.
That's a poem by Emily Dickinson. I wish I could remember the poem. I'm afraid I can't now, but it starts out that the soul should always stand ajar. And the point of it as it goes on is that if you don't, the heavenly visitor won't be able to encounter you. You know, in other words, from imagination's point of view, she uses the word heaven. I think meaning imagination. So if your soul isn't open a little bit, then all the time, and that's what I was saying about the mirror, if you're not open, These intuitions will just pass you by, and you won't pay any attention to them. And all you're left with then are your rational ideas to make your decisions. And they're not enough. I'm telling you, they're not enough. We need to be intuitive in this world to make good decisions, decisions that are consonant with our deep, deep feelings and desires. They're so deep that we need something much more intuitive to touch them. So I think that's what Emily Dickinson is saying. It probably applies to her role as a poet, that she had to be open to the influence, to be inspired, to get ideas and to get insights. And I certainly feel that as a writer, if I write a book and if I'm not open to inspiration, the book feels flat. It feels like I'm just writing it out of my brain instead of being inspired. There's a huge difference between those two things.
I think too, as you say that, and I think about, you know, when you said we sort of ignore, and I know you've written about this in many ways, you know, we sort of ignore soul at our own peril, because soul will come back and find us one way or the other.
Yeah, hit you over the head. Yes, I think this is Freud's idea. You know, he called it the return of the repressed. That if you repress something, it doesn't go away. It comes back in a more dangerous form, or more difficult form. And I think that's true about soul as well. We ignore the soul all the time. That means that deep, deep part of us that is full of these intuitions and where we have deep feelings and longings and fears. We ignore that, our personal history and so on. We just live in a practical way. We believe the people around us telling us to live in a world that's purely practical. And in order to live a more soulful life, I think you have to resist the culture around you. I've always been saying that. You have to resist the culture and be eccentric. And I feel that the older I get, the more, the freer I feel to be eccentric. I mean, I definitely feel freer about that. I don't look more eccentric. You know, I don't dress up and look differently. But in my own thinking and living, I don't follow the world around me at all. I go against it. Not that I'm trying to rebel, but that I find when I'm paying attention to my own intuitions and living a more soulful life, I'm not fitting into the norm.
I remember coming to see you at a book signing. Must have been maybe 95, 96. It was many years ago in New York City. And I remember something that you said actually then that really struck me, where you had talked about, you know, you said, if I wrote a book called, you know, the 15 ways to, you know, make your life better, or the 7 steps to happiness, that people, you know, that it would just make, you know, it'd be easier, you know, but that's not who I am, that, you know, your work doesn't, its soul doesn't lend itself to that kind of simplicity and rationality.
Yes, I wish it did. You know, I'd have a little more money. but no, it doesn't lend itself, and you have to be true to yourself. I'm lucky that I've done as well as I have, I think, because I'm pretty quirky. And, you know, I love ideas. I love history, and I learn so much from, you know, I read Latin and Greek, you know, that kind of thing. So I do all that, but at the same time, I don't like the academic world very much. I tried it, and it just didn't work for me. So I like to be an independent writer in the world, but it's hard to make a living at it and to have people follow you if you're being, you know, sort of half academic and interested in all these obscure things. So I do my best to make it intelligible and attractive, but I don't cheat on it. You know, in other words, I try to be honest to myself at the same time. I find that a very interesting challenge, and so far it's worked out for me. Although these days, I have to say, it's getting more and more difficult to publish, but that's because of the state of publishing today. It's not easy.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm curious about sort of what's different now than sort of when you had started.
I think that when I started out, well, first of all, there were many, many bookstores that were independent, and the independent bookstores carry a lot of unusual books, a lot big range of books, you know, books that the owners really like. And usually they're pretty well read, those owners. And now it's reduced to larger bookstores, or to Amazon, something like that, you know, and the reviews on Amazon are not very intelligent usually. So that's a problem. And the other thing is that the publishing houses have been reduced to just a handful. When I started out, there were hundreds, just all kinds of them. So they were publishing a whole mass of books, different kinds of books that were very interesting, and all different levels, you know, academic to popular in nonfiction. But today, when I talk to publishers, they're nervous because they feel they can't survive unless they sell bestsellers all the time. Well, you know, I did write a few bestsellers, but that was pretty lucky. That was magic. When I think about magic, I think, wow, Care of the Soul was the biggest magic I ever had, you know, to be able to sell a book that like that. So it's difficult today, I think, because of the economic pressures.
Your work, though, really taps into, I think one of the reasons that you know, people are still drawn to your work and to you is because, at least from what I see, is that it does speak to a hunger that isn't always fed in a world that's so filled with practicality and rationality and even spirit.
Yeah, so I'm glad you added that last word, spirit, because my work is really not, for the most part, in the spiritual realm. I do write some spiritual books, but generally speaking, I'm interested in a different direction, which would be the deeper side, you know, like your show, you know, the imagination and dream and fantasy and history, personal history and memory and poetry and the arts and gardening, you know, in your home and living in a place. I mean, all these very soulful issues are still the most important to me. And I really believe that taking care of your soul, which should be the work of psychology and psychotherapy, but really isn't in our modern world, has to do with it's you know, it's external as well as internal, and that's where the enchantment comes in. I think if you make a home that is enchanting, that is one that you really want to live in, that draws you, that you can love, and you want your friends there, well, that's magic in itself. If you can do that, nobody can tell you how to do that. You know, they can give you some ideas, but you have to create that for yourself, and that's a work of magic. If you can do that, then you're going to have a sense of security and peace that you won't have in any other way. You can be making a lot of money and not have that feeling of security and peace.
You know, one of the images that came to me as you were talking about, as we were talking about this, about magic and about enchantment, is I have a 7-year-old son, and I'll bring him to school in the morning, and you see the kids come out and they're running towards the, you know, they're running towards the front of the door, and they're telling him, slow down, slow down. But the look on their faces, they truly have the sense of they're going to play on the playground, and they turn into whatever they're going to turn into. And you just, I just get the sense of that it's just this natural sense of the world being enchanted and magical, and that somehow we just, we lose that along the way.
Yeah, I agree completely. I raised two kids, and I had that experience so many times. My daughter is 20 now, and she's visiting this weekend, and we're telling the old story so much because she did live a very enchanted life growing up, and I think I learned from a lot from her and from her brother, you know, what the enchantment means. And like you said, they give them a playground, and they can do anything. You know, they start making things up right away. They look out there, an adult might see pavement, and the child sees a whole world to create. And I think you're right, we lose that. So part of the work of becoming a magus, which is the name of the, you know, a magician, someone who practices natural magic, part of becoming that person is to recover what children have. I don't think you have to become childlike, really, but you have to recover the spirit that you've lost, for sure.
Well, I cannot believe this. We're running down our last 5 minutes here. I want to make sure, a couple things. I just want to make sure to send people to www.careofthesoul.net, to your website, because you have many, many more books than you've been, you know, you have, I think, over 20 books now?
Yes, about 20.
About 20. But I also just want to open up to you in terms of, you know, upcoming places that you're going to be and so forth.
Yes, if I can think of them now. I'm going to be on Cape Cod, where I teach psychiatrists. I believe that's around July 9th. And that's for the New England Educational Institute. And then I'm going out to going to Findhorn at the end of September. And they're having their celebration of their anniversary over there, which is in Scotland. And it should be a wonderful event. It's called Love, Magic, and Miracles there. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to be talking about natural magic there and teaching people how to use the mirror and how to do various intuitive techniques. I'm also going to be giving a talk there on spirituality, because I've recently written a book on the Gospels, and I've translated the Gospels from Greek. So I'm going to give a talk on Jesus' spirituality, too, while I'm there. So my website has all the events coming up, and I think they're getting more and more exciting and interesting. I'm enjoying them tremendously.
Yeah, I'm really excited about, I know, you know, you've been doing a lot of work with, you know, obviously in the medical field and with medicine, and bringing soul into that. But it is really exciting to see that. I love that you're, you know, just doing your thing and just sort of seeing where it takes you and just sort of playing with it, you know, which is
great. There's something about letting go any worry about. I used to worry too much about audiences. I think what they want and what they would think. Today, I don't worry about it. We just have a good time.
The other thing I feel like I really learned from your work is this idea of there's some rational part of me that wants everything to make sense, like every experience, everything I do, it's all going to be part of this master plan. And there's something about soulfulness where it's untidy and there's just, you know, it weaves and winds in its own way.
Yes, that's the beauty of it. It also, of course, makes it more difficult to do in some ways, but it doesn't have the burden of that ordered life. You know, I've lived that life where everything is quite ordered, and it's freeing in some ways, but in other ways, it's a real burden. So, yeah, you live the soulful life, and you follow your intuitions, and you relax, and you make sure that you have fun. That's a good word for the soul.
Absolutely. Thomas More, thank you so much for joining me today. It goes by way too quickly. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me again, Doug, and I hope that we can continue our conversation another time.
I would love to. Thanks so much. So thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening. And again, this is Doug Foresta at Imagining the Future. I just want to encourage everyone, if you do enjoy the show, to pass along the word of I'm really excited about all the great guests we have on, and encourage you to visit Thomas Moore at www.careofthesoul.net. Take care, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.